From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. You want a one-word secret to living a longer life? Here it is, ikigai. It's a Japanese word used on the island of Okinawa, and roughly translated, it means your purpose. The Okinawans live much, much longer lives, and one of the reasons is their ikigai. They know their purpose. And this is just one of the things Dan Buettner learned when he set about to figure out why the people living in these certain places, places like Icaria, Greece, Sardinia, Italy, Okinawa, why they live such long and healthy lives. Buettner called these places blue zones. He wrote a popular book about them. But here's what he's been thinking about lately. Could you create your own blue zone in a place that wasn't close to being blue, like West Valley City or Waterloo, Iowa? Buettner thinks you can. And today in the program, he's talking about how. Join us after the news.
The program you're listening to right now is made possible by more than 5,500 loyal public radio listeners. KUER sustainers give monthly contributions to ensure the station has a reliable source of income. So the next time you learn something new on Science Friday, or you're stuck in your driveway gripped by a conversation on Weekend Edition, give thanks to the sustaining members who are at the heart of the programs that you love. Become a sustainer today at KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about blue zones. And maybe you already know what a blue zone is or you've heard about them. A blue zone is the name Dan Buettner and his team of researchers came up with to describe these particular places in the world that had people who lived long, really long, and healthy lives. People who had managed to grow old without heart problems or obesity or diabetes or cancer. Buettner wrote a very popular book about blue zones, a New York Times best-selling book about it, where he teased out their habits and their practices. We'll talk about some of those today because a lot of these are really fascinating. And here's a little tease. People who live in blue zones don't go to the gym and run the Ragnar. They move. They live in a place that nudges. That's a word Buettner uses from time to time, nudges them to move, like walk to a friend's house or to church. And they have purpose, and they eat plants, and they don't stuff themselves, and they have large groups of friends in a community. So we'll talk about blue zones today, but here's what Dan Buettner's been trying to figure out lately. Could you make a blue zone in another place? That is, if you could take a typical American community and talk them into the advantages of living a blue zone life, could they then make their own blue zone? In other words, could you reshape a city? Buettner says you can, and today in the program, we're going to talk about how. Dan Buettner, National Geographic Fellow, an author, a researcher, back in 2008, he published the book, The Blue Zones, Lessons for Longer Living from the People Who Lived the Longest. He's since released an updated version of that book, and we'll talk about that a little bit later. His latest book is called The Blue Zones Solution, Eating and Living Like the World's Healthiest People. Both of those are New York Times bestsellers, and Dan Buettner is joining us today from a studio in Minneapolis. That's where he's based. Dan Buettner, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
It's a delight to be here.
Well, let me start with the basics before we get to the particulars. What was it that got you started thinking about all of this? I know this has been a long journey for you now, but was there one particular moment, or was it something that kind of came to you gradually?
Gradually. For about a decade before finding the first Blue Zones areas, I was leading scientific expeditions for National Geographic's and under my own interest. And most of those centered around the notion of harnessing an online audience and harnessing wisdom of the crowd to solve ancient mysteries. And we've been trying to figure out why the Maya civilization collapsed in Central America, and did Marco Polo really go to China? And then in the year 2000, we stumbled upon a really interesting mystery. The World Health Organization found this tiny archipelago of islands in the South Pacific had the longest, healthiest life expectancy in the world. That was Okinawa, Japan. And I knew that to be a melting pot of all kinds of nationalities. So I knew there wasn't anything genetic going on there. So I thought, aha, they must be doing something that explains 10 or 20 times more people reaching age 100 than surrounding areas. So we sought to unravel that mystery.
Yeah. It's important to say that this process involved lots and lots of, you know, data gathering, and anthropologists were involved and medical researchers and epidemiologists. But it's interesting, you also say that you found that it was really helpful just to sit with 100-year-old people and listen to their stories. Would you explain what it is you got from that part of it? I mean, it's all anecdotal, but you certainly learned something from that those conversations.
Well, it starts very much evidence-based. So we spend 3 years with demographers to verify the ages of these places. So these are really places where people are living measurably longer, and that was the part of the iceberg you don't see. Hmm. I have a very clever editor at National Geographic named Peter Miller, and he urged me not to just interview 100 centenarians but actually go live with a centenarian. Yeah. So, you know, I speak no Okinawan, and I go to these tiny huts in northern Okinawa and get an introduction and live for 2 days. And it's really observing the nuances that I think gave this book the story-driven hook that catches people's information or interest.
Yeah. One of the questions you ask early in your first Blue Zone book is, what exactly is aging? And maybe we should start there. Give us a sense of what we know aging is, because I think there's this sense, and you write about this, I think there's kind of this myth that we have that we can escape it. But maybe we should get that out of the way. We can't. We know that. We're going to die, but everyone's going to get old too.
Yeah. So there's essentially two brands of aging. One brand is trying to extend the ceiling to how long human beings could live. So the longest human lifespan is established by a French woman named Marie Calme. She lived 122 years and 4 months, and that's the upper limit. The average maximum life expectancy of the human species living in the first world is about 92. Hmm. So your listeners, if people are trying to sell you something that suggest that you can live over 100, they probably have their hand in your pocket. But the average person can expect to live to 92. To make it to 100, you have to have won the genetic lottery.
Yeah.
The other kind of aging, the technical definition of aging, is the buildup of cellular and molecular damage over time. And about once every 7 years, almost every cell in your body reproduces itself, and out with the old, in with the new. So you're actually more of a verb than you are a noun. Yeah. And every time cells reproduce themselves, there's a little bit of damage, and that damage doubles. So actually a 65-year-old person is not only a lot older, they're aging at a rate of about 125 times faster than a 12-year-old person. And Blue Zones focuses mostly on the former type of aging. We're interested in eliminating the things that foreshorten your life so that you can get those 92 good years you have coming to you.
Yeah. You once asked a woman in Ikaria, Greece, why people there lived so long. And she had this answer that seems telling in some way. She said, "We just forgot to die." And you said there's a kind of truth in that statement. What is it that you get from that statement?
There's absolute truth, and there's also deep insight, by the way, because in none of these five places where people are living a long time and standing on their head at age 100, did they ever say at age 50, "Well, God darn it, I'm going to get on a longevity diet and live another 50 years or buy a treadmill." They actually have no idea why they live so long. And that led us to the deeper insight, which is, well, where people live a long time, it's because longevity happened to them.
Yeah.
We tend to think of health and longevity as something we pursue in this country. But the reality is it's something that ensues.
Yeah.
It is the result of the right environment.
That is, it seems like if you were to boil down a theme, it's almost that's what it is, this idea of the environment. And you were making reference earlier to one of our producers on the program, this new study, paper study that was published in the Journal of the American Medical Association that showed this correlation between longevity and zip code, which tells you what? I mean, that sort of gets to your idea that you've been thinking about for a long time, that this is about environment. It's about place, right?
It is. We've long known that rich people live longer than poor people, but this new study shows that actually parts of America, cities that invest in people and do things like limit trans fat and levy tobacco taxes and make walking easier than driving. Those are the areas in America where people are living longer. And it turns out that environment, it's a bigger driver of how long you live than health insurance. And we spend so much time looking at you know, Obamacare and the $2.1 trillion we spend on the quote-unquote health care and related costs, while largely missing the gorilla in the room, which is the environment we live in. Mm-hmm.
And I want to get into that as we go. It's interesting, your latest book. When you talk about all of the habits and practices of people who live in these blue zones, you get a sense that it is so much more than diet. And we'll break down some of these practices, the power nine, as you say, you know, moving and having purpose, all those kinds of things, because I want to talk about those as we go. But why did you focus on this latest book on food? Because it's a lot about diet, clearly, but why focus on that, do you think?
Yeah, and this is disruptive, but actually it's nothing about diet.
Yeah.
In none of these places are people trying to buck up or be disciplined or eat the right foods. But I realize in this country the runway for a healthier lifestyle is through our mouths. We eat three times a day. There are food programs and food networks, and we like to eat in this country. And it provides a daily reminder, I think, of the right way to live. We did a meta-analysis to try to find out what centenarians really ate for the past 100 years. Mm-hmm. 155 studies done in all five blue zones. Because if you want to know what a centenarian ate to live a long time, you can't ask them what they ate yesterday. You have to know what they were eating when they were 10 and when they were 30 and when they were 50. So we found dietary surveys and more or less did a distillation to find out what they really ate. But in every case, the reason they were eating the right foods was because, number one, the healthier foods were more accessible. Number two, they were the most affordable. Number three, they had time-honored recipes to make them taste good. I could tell you broccoli is a secret to longevity, but if you don't like broccoli, you're not going to live a long time.
Right.
And finally, their kitchens were set up to make so that making those healthy foods were easiest. And then they ate with friends who liked the same kinds of food. So it was a constant reinforcement virtuous circle.
Yeah. The organizing principle for this latest book, you say you found in Acharya, Greece, and it was during this meal, and one of your lunch companions was gesturing to this food that was laid out before you, and you had fresh fish there, and I think it was black-eyed peas, and there was bread and local wine. And she said this, you asked this question, she said, feed them. Explain what that
means.
Yes,
I was trying to make the first blue zone, American blue zone, a small town in the Midwest called Albert Lea, a meatpacking plant. And their definition of vegetables are like those little orange flecks you see in a hamburger helper. So I was trying to bring this diet to them. And the woman was Dr. Antonio Tricopula, and she's largely responsible for what we know about the Mediterranean diet these days. And she closed her eyes and thought for a moment and opened her eyes and said, feed them. So as a result, I got the very best recipe in Icarian, kind of a black-eyed fennel stew. I call it Icarian stew. And I made that stew for the entire city of Albert Lea, Minnesota, 18,000 people, and they ate every bit of it. And they brought that flavor memory to their homes. And it's a lot easier to convince people to eat plant-based foods if they know something. They know the recipe and they know they like it.
I want to come back to Albert Lea because I think it's an important – it's a critical part of the recent book, and that is whether or not you can manufacture a blue zone in another place. You know, whether these are just unique or you can transplant some of these ideas. So we'll get back to it. Let me ask you about the Mediterranean diet in particular. Icaria was one of these places, Greece. You mentioned a woman named Athena Mazzari, and you were able to talk her into letting you watch her work in the kitchen. And it seems like you got a lot from that. Would you talk a little bit about that experience? Because some of the basics of the Mediterranean diet I wanted to maybe go through if we could.
Yes, it was a guest house named Thea's Guest House on the Aegean Sea, but a very kind of out of the way part of Icaria. And this is Athena is a woman who's grown up in her family's grown up there for the past 2,000 years, and most of the ingredients that she adds to her cooking grow within about a mile of where she is. She'll go out and harness these greens that look like weeds that grow on the side of the side of the freeway, and bake them into delicious pies. But watching her within arm's reach, she had all the right utensils and all the right pots and pans. She was using all local ingredients, and she clearly loved what she was doing. And the foods that she was making, what mostly they were the base of them were beans. And greens and sourdough bread, but she knew how to make those very simple and consummately healthy ingredients taste like a symphony.
So what did you – I guess the thing that I keep wondering about, and we can talk about some of these other traditional diets as we go. I mean, looking at bread here. I'm looking at potatoes. I'm looking at feta cheese. Lemons, chickpeas. These are sort of what you call the longevity foods from Icaria. High in carbs. There's a lot of starch in some of these. Some are believed to cause inflammation. I mean, like what is it about that diet that you could translate into just basic rules related to, you know, nutrition, for example?
Well, if you take a worldwide average of the longest lived people and what they've eaten over the last 100 years, including Icaria, between 90 and 100% of what they're consumed come from plants. Mm-hmm. They do eat meat, but only about five times a month. The cornerstone of every longevity diet in the world is beans. Mm-hmm. It's a very high-carb diet, but when I say carb, you have to realize that both lollipops and lentil beans are carbs. The type of carbs they're eating are more like the lentil beans. Whole grains, sweet potatoes. They have a type of bread, a sourdough bread, very different from the bread we eat. When you just make bread from yeast, mm-hmm. It creates a fluffy, delicious bread, but that tends to have a lot of gluten in it. But in Icaria, they'll leaven the bread with a bacteria called lactobacillus. And the process of leavening it with bacteria actually consumes about 95% of all the gluten. And there are a number of studies done with that bread that show that when you eat a sourdough bread with a meal, it lowers the glycemic load of the entire meal. And the point is that they don't do it, just do it like once in a while, but they eat this bread with every meal for years or a decade. So it's the sum of lots of small things. But the result is about an extra decade of life and a fraction of the rate of dementia and heart disease. And they grow old the way we want to grow old.
Right. It's funny, you say in the book that food helps us determine the company we keep. Because in some ways it's a reflection of, I think you put it this way, of what we believe, like our values, I suppose.
Yeah, so the way we think about eating healthier in this country is individual responsibility. I'm going to buck up and I'm going to eat healthy food and weigh how much protein is in my breakfast and so forth. And that never works. I defy anybody to tell me about a diet that works for more than about 3% of the people who start it 2 years later. What works in these blue zones to get people eating the right food for the long run is their group of friends. In places like Okinawa, they call this a moai, yeah, a committed social network. But you see variations in Icaria and Sardinia and Costa Rica. So when people are getting together and eating, they're eating this healthy food as a social celebration or a social daily event. So they're not the type of people who are gathering around, you know, a barbecue every day and smoking cigars and swilling Jim Beam. They're people for whom their default meals are things like delicious beans and greens and salads and stews.
Yeah, which gets us to one of the Power Nine that you write about. You know, one of these nine characteristics or habits of people in blue zones, and that is having a social network, having the right tribe, is how you put it. Talk a little bit more about that. I've heard you say that for a lot, it seems like that the number of people we can count as friends is shrinking. Is that right?
Yes. So about 20 years ago, the average American had three good friends, and we're now down to about 1.5. And according to Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, they've done a survey, and the core of the survey is asking people how many friends they have with whom they can have a meaningful conversation, and number two, they can count on a bad day.
Right.
And about 20% of Americans cannot say they have three friends that meet that criteria. And those people have a life expectancy of about 8 years fewer than those people with a good social network, five or so best friends. So having a group of friends is essential for our longevity. And we know that health behaviors are as contagious as catching a cold. I've worked some with Nicholas Christakis, and he's done the work to find that if your three best friends are unhealthy and obese, there's about 150% better chance that you'll be overweight yourself. So curating a group of four or five healthy friends is about the most dependable thing you can do to add good years to your life and live a longer, healthier life on the way.
Yeah. Dan Buettner is with us. He's the author of several books based on the idea of the world's so-called blue zones. His most recent is called The Blue Zones Solution, Eating and Living Like the World's Healthiest People. You can join the conversation, by the way, if you have a comment or a question. 801-585-WEST is the number. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. We'll take a break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about what it takes to live a longer, more healthy life. The longer life part may be up to your genes in some ways, but Dan Buettner has identified these spots, these blue zones, as he calls them, around the world where people live incredibly long and healthy lives. Some of the secrets which we're talking about, moving naturally, having a purpose, drinking wine. But there's also a question he's been working out lately. Could you recreate a blue zone in a typical American city? His latest book is The Blue Zones Solution, Eating and Living Like the World's Healthiest People. 801-585-WEST is the number. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. So one of the blue zones that you identified was the highlands of Sardinia, Italy. You spent, 3 days wandering around with a shepherd there. What did you learn in that experience?
Well, in these highlands, on the island of Sardinia, the people live on the coast. They don't live any longer than their Italian counterparts. It's only these shepherds. So the way to find their lifestyle, we thought, was to actually live with them for a while. First of all, they don't work all that hard. They wake up when the sun's warm. They spend a little time with their animals. They have mostly sheep. They'll pasture their animals, maybe walk gently for a couple hours. They stop for lunch. They take a nap, a couple more hours walking with their animals. And then by 5 o'clock, they're back in the village drinking wine. It's regular low-intensity physical activity. They had to come up with a diet that was portable and that wouldn't spoil if they were away a few days or weeks pasturing their animals. They came up with a type of bread. And this, of course, has evolved over centuries. They call it carta de musica.
Yeah.
And it looks like a really flat pizza dough bread crust. And it's made with durum wheat, which is the wheat we make our pastas out of. And it lasts a long time. They'll make some cheese out of their sheep's milk. It's a pecorino cheese, but it's grass-fed animals, very high in omega-3 fatty acids. And they have a type of wine there, sun redden. It's so red that, in fact, they call it vino nero, or black wine, that has the highest levels of polyphenols of any other known wine. It's called Cannonau. That's a varietal, not a brand. And they'll drink that with a certain amount of regularity throughout the day, but not great amounts, just a small glass, maybe mid-morning, maybe at lunch, and then with their buddies after work in the village square.
Mm. It's interesting, the eggs and lard, the wine, a lot of the stuff that you kind of think of as kind of counterintuitive, but it works for them. Again, the environmental factors are the things that also play into all of this, I guess.
Well, I want to make a point about the eggs and the lard and the meat. They do eat pork, but it's rare. I mean, they might use a spoonful of lard to saute their vegetables. They'll eat eggs, but these were free-range eggs, and they might, on average, about 3 eggs a week, not a 3-egg omelet 5 days a week. Meat, pork, was a celebratory food, usually after church on Sunday or during a village fest. Most of their food for most of the past century was plants, and that is the very clear message I took away from 10 years of observing centenaries. Their default foods are plants.
A plant slant is how you describe it in the first book. I mean, and you've singled out the fava bean. It seems like if you, I don't know if that's your perfect food, but that's certainly one that you've identified as really, really great for you.
So the cornerstone, Doug, of every longevity diet in the world is beans, about a cup of beans a day. And we know that people are just eating a couple grams or 20 or 30 grams of beans today are adding years to their life expectancy. And when you sort of dig down on the science behind the bean, it's not only a very inexpensive protein, a much healthier and cheaper protein than a protein you would get from animal products. It's vitamins, complex carbohydrates. But it also actually changes the bacteria in your gut. It takes about 2 weeks. But if you're a big meat and cheese eater right now and you replace those proteins with a cup of beans a day, the bacteria that starts to thrive are anti-inflammatory bacteria. So there's all kinds of subtle ways that add up over time to stack the deck in favor of health over time.
I want to ask you about this idea of moving naturally. This is one of those 9 habits that you identified. And it seems like this is going to get some people confused, that the people who live the longest aren't the gym rats. They're not running marathons. And this is the thing, you know, I mentioned your term nudge, because they live in environments, you say, that nudge them into moving. Explain what that means in practical terms, creating an environment where they keep moving.
Yes. So we focus so much on exercise, and you always hear diet and exercise. But, you know, exercise has been a public health failure for the past 70 years. The average American burns fewer than 100 calories a day engaged in quote-unquote exercise, that planful time in the gym or running. In blue zones, people are nudged into movement every 20 minutes or so, and that's because they, again, it's a residue of their environment. So every time they go to work or to a friend's house, when their kids go to school, when they go out to eat, at occasions a walk. Their houses are deconvenienced. There's not a button to push for housework and another button to push for yard work and another button to push for kitchen work. They knead bread by hand and grind corn and do yard work by hand. They have gardens out back. So every day they're nudged into weeding or watering or harvesting their vegetables. So their day is just landmine with these little opportunities to move, which not only collectively burns a lot more calories than you would if you sit at your desk all day and then try to make it up in the gym, but it also keeps their metabolisms running higher. So they're burning off calories when they're not even thinking about it between those moments of activity.
There is a blue zone in the United States, in Loma Linda, California. This, of course, is the Seventh-day Adventists, where they're centered. Let's talk a little bit about what you learned from the Seventh-day Adventists. They get their dietary guidelines from the Bible, like from the first chapter of Genesis, I think it is, that sort of gives them a basic guideline for how to...
Verses 27 through 29... God has given his people every tree that bears fruit and every plant that bears seed. And when you interpret that a little bit, you get fruits, vegetables. Mm-hmm. Seeds are grains. They're beans. They're nuts. And the longest live Americans, in fact, this comes from the Adventist Health Study, which the different waves of it have followed over 100,000 Americans for 30 years, a gold standard epidemiology study. And sure enough, the Adventists who are vegan or pescatarian, they're vegan and eat a little bit of fish, they live longer than the meat eaters among this group. And so we want to find out how they're able to maintain that for months or years at a time.
And what did you find? I mean, because I guess this also gets us to another one of those habits and practices about coupling the kind of food you eat with the environment around you. And this was the faith-based community. I mean, this seems to also make a difference.
Yes, and it goes back to I like to get away from the notion of habits because I don't think they work for long enough. Mm. Again, it's unconscious with these people as well. The Adventists in Loma Linda, they tend to hang out with other Adventists. They celebrate their Sabbath on Saturday instead of Sunday. So that means their kids aren't going to football games and dances on Friday night. On Saturdays, they're not doing things with their neighbors. They tend to hang out with other Adventists. They have their church on Saturday morning. Then Saturday afternoon, they take a nature hike. And Saturday for lunch, they all get together. And because there's such a plant slant to their community, the potlucks are all plant-based. So they don't have to think about it. They don't have to muster discipline to do it. And like you said, they're religious and they take certain things fairly literally from the Bible. And it's reinforced in all facets of their lives every day.
No pork for them or shellfish because that's prohibited in the Bible. You see in Okinawan, the Okinawans eat a little bit of pork. You mentioned the Sardinians eat a little bit of pork. So there's kind of a difference, I guess. Alcohol is discouraged among the Seventh-day Adventists, but it seems to be a part of other people in Blue Zone. I guess you can't translate these necessarily, right? I mean, that wouldn't make any sense because you'd have to, because some of them do some things, some of them don't do things.
Yeah, but there's a common denominators in their diet no matter where you go. Beans are huge, central for the Adventist diet as they are in Ikaria and Okinawa. Okinawa, it happens to be the soybeans. Nuts are a snack in every Blue Zone diet. Water is the go-to beverage.
Yeah.
Again, 90% of what they're eating are plant-based. So you can draw we try to get away from this notion of prescribing the exact kind of food.
Yeah.
But you can see the same sort of dietary groupings which give us powerful lessons on what we ought to be doing in our lives.
Dan Buettner is with us, the author of several books based on the Blue Zones concept. His most recent is called The Blue Zones Solution, Eating and Living Like the World's Healthiest People. We'll take another quick break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with Dan Buettner. We're talking about some of the ideas in his books on Blue Zones, Eating and Living Like the World's Healthiest People. The Blue Zones Solution is his latest book. I wanted to ask you, one of the big questions that you get at in this latest is whether a community could decide to become a Blue Zone. And I guess you were wondering if you could, I guess, just recreate the experience or I wonder, were you wondering if these just happened organically? Was that sort of the question you were thinking about at first?
Well, after writing the Blue Zones, I got to go on all these TV talk shows and you'd see in the green room there'd be some other health expert. And I just realized that I spent 5 years of my life to put this together and it was solid information. People were reacting the right way, but I knew it would go in one ear and out the other. So I got to thinking, I wonder if you could actually make it stick. And I wonder if you could make it stick to for a whole city. Mm-hmm. And I work with the University of Minnesota School of Public Health. And I started meeting with them. John Finnegan, who's the dean over there, convened a group of public health experts. And we got I showed them the principles of Blue Zones, and I got them to help me architect how to bring a Blue Zone to an American city based on a lot of trial and error that's happened in this country over the past 50 years or so.
You found one story in Finland where they actually they managed to turn things around. Let's talk about. There's a great character in this story. Is it Pekka Puska? Am I getting that name?
Puska, yeah.
Puska?
Pekka Puska.
Yeah,
he's a brilliant man and my inspiration. So I got another grant from National Geographic to try to find parts of the world where people were unhealthy and got healthier as part of this. And looked through CDC and the World Health Organization, found that it's never been done successfully in America. All these sort of heart healthy programs and vitality cities, they always start out with lots of enthusiasm but then go back to their baseline in just a few years. Finland, North Karelia, Finland, this 142,000 people on the border of Russia, so eastern Finland, highest rate of cardiovascular disease in the world in 1972. Guys 55 years old were dropping dead of heart disease. And Pekka Puska, at the time, is a young physician and public health graduate. He's in his late 20s, was assigned to make this area healthier. And he started by doing all the things that public health people try to do. They try to get people on diets and fun runs and publicity and so forth. And he ran through his entire budget in 5 years. And then he started working with an epidemiologist named Jeffrey Rose in London, who had figured out statistically that if you want to get a population healthier, you don't aim the intervention at the sickest people. But you look at the whole population and change the intervention. And he got the first idea, actually, to change the environment. And he did things like engineered a new type of canola oil to replace butter. And even though citrus fruit was too expensive, he helped create a market for the berries. So there was a year-long market to sell berries. People in North Korea love their sausage, big fatty sausage. And you weren't going to get Finns to stop eating their sausage. But he convinced the regional sausage maker to take out 30% of the fat and 20% of the salt, replace it with a mushroom filler. So people were eating the same amount of sausage, yet the health factor of that sausage increased by 20%. And he just set up silver buckshot of healthy nudges and defaults that was right for Finland. And lo and behold, over about a 3-decade period, he helped lower the rate of cardiovascular disease by 80% and certain stomach cancers and so forth by about 60%. Mm-hmm. And he went on to run the World Health Organization's division of non-infectious disease. So great story.
Yeah. And you learned some lessons in terms of how you could translate something like that here. One of them is, lobbying food producers. Pekka Puska does that. But this always raises that question of why would a food producer really care about people's health? I mean, if they're packing sugar and salt and fat into food to get people addicted to it, why would they even listen to your argument about public health?
Well, I don't think food producers are evil. until about the 1960s, there weren't enough calories in this country to feed the number of mouths there were. And ingenuity has gotten us where we are. But now there's just too many calories and they're too cheap. And to get producers, I think, to make their foods healthier, there needs to be some encouragement from government, and there also needs to be a market receptive to the products that gradually replace them. And that really seems to be the magic bullet. Tobacco, about 50% of us smoked in the 1950s, and we're now down to about 20%, and that's because of three levers. We made smoking more expensive. We educated people, namely kids, and we made the environment more restrictive. Right now, soda pops is the number one source of sugar in the American diet. Those three levers we're seeing are already work at lowering soda pop consumption. And we can do the same thing with other foods that aren't so good for us. But you can't force cities to do it, but we're finding with these blue zone cities that if you show them the evidence, they often take it on themselves.
So you write about Spencer, Iowa. You mentioned Albert Lee as another. What's the case that you make? Because you did these presentations in front of mayors and city managers and, you know, people from the Chamber of Commerce. What are the presentations like, and how are they reacting to these presentations?
Well, with health messages, like almost anything else, if you wrap it in a story, you can touch people's hearts. So I have these great blue zone stories from around the world of centenarians who are still vigorous after 10 centuries and with four generations of kids, and that resonates with people. And then I make the point they got into their 100th year not because of discipline. It's because they live in the right environment. And I essentially posed them, how would you like to set up your environment so that your kids grow up healthy and that you have the best chances of reaching that healthy age 92? And if they raise their hand, if they say yes, then we take it to the next step. And then the real work begins.
I wanted to ask about if there's a kind of political dimension to the subject that you have to overcome. I mean, remember all the hubbub in New York City when Mayor Bloomberg had this campaign against sugary soda and it became really polarizing and kind of political? Did you confront any of that? Is that an issue in this country?
We do an end round around it. We do Bloomberg interventions, but in a very different way than trying to ramrod it down the political process. So the secret is we audition cities and we open up our kimono. We're trying to make the healthy choice the easy or the unavoidable choice in your city. And that requires limiting freedoms of doing unhealthy things. Mm. And if that's right for you, we'll come in. So we actually make the mayor, the city manager, the superintendent of schools, the head of public health, the chamber of commerce sign a pledge saying they understand that before we'll even come in. And then once we have leadership signed on, then we already know that they're receptive to the ideas, and we bring in these bundles of policies that make healthy food cheaper and more accessible, that make streets more friendly to humans rather than just cars, and that restrict tobacco. Mm-hmm. And in each case, there are 20 or 30 policies, and we gather these leaders together and say, you know what? You don't have to do anything. You don't have to tax sodas. You don't have to adopt a complete street policy, but you got us down here. Mm. Now you're going to do something. And we show them these menu of 30, and we ask if they want to become a blue zone city, they have to pick 8 or 10 of them. And you know what? Even in the most conservative cities like Fort Worth, Texas, and Spencer, Iowa, and Naples, Florida, they're doing them because you're not coming in with a nanny state mentality. Yeah. You're coming in with a number of healthy, evidence-based choices that are right for them.
I want to get to some of the questions we're getting. This is a question from Tyler. How much of the longevity effect might be attributed to just eating fewer calories? And this is one of those food rituals you talk about. And in fact, it's one of those sort of lifestyle things that you see out there, this kind of 80% rule, that the idea of not stuffing yourself, basically, I guess.
Yeah, so there are a number. He's absolutely right. So the only proven way to slow down the aging process is through something called caloric restriction, which is cutting out about 30% of the calories we eat every day. But how do you really do that? So some of the lessons we see in blue zones is they eat breakfast like a king, lunch like a prince, and dinner like a pauper. And that occasions consuming fewer calories. Pre-plating your food at the counter and then bringing the right amount to the table as compared to eating it family style. That will occasion eating 20% fewer calories. And by the way, eating plants, meat and cheese and eggs are calorically dense. So a lot of calories, not a lot of food. You'll sit down an Okinawan meal and it'll be with the daikon and wonderfully spiced and tofu, and the plate looks like this delicious compost pile, and you can eat away at it for 10 or 15 minutes and come away with a really full, satisfied stomach, and you've consumed fewer calories than you would have if you would have eaten a small hamburger. So yes, eating less is a key, and there are lots of ways to do it other than starving yourself.
Right. Here's another question. Do family members count as friends? You talk about the importance of cultivating these social groups. Can you count family members in that group?
Family members absolutely count.
Yeah.
And it is so clear in these blue zones that they keep their aging parents nearby, which not only conveys 4 to 6 extra years of life expectancy, but something called the grandmother effect has shown that children who live in a home with a grandparent actually have lower rates of disease and mortality. So it's a virtuous circle of including your family as your best friends.
Here's one from Troy. Are there athletes in these blue zones? Do they run or bike long distances?
Not really.
Yeah.
Maybe in the Loma Linda blue zone, but their day is laced with physical activity. I mean, of course, all five of these blue zones, the American food culture and globalism is hitting it like a tsunami. So they're all changing and, in a sense, disappearing. But when you take the average of the last centenarians, of the last century, rather, exercise was never an important element of their health.
You write about blue zoning, as you put it, this sort of various parts of your life, your kitchen, for example, or your home. I wanted to go through some of these things that you suggest. Have only one TV in your home, for example. That's important?
Yeah, the amount of time your child watches TV is the biggest predictor of whether or not your child will be obese. So the more screens you have in your house, the more TV you watch. So only having one and having it out of the way lessens the amount of screen time.
Own a dog?
If you own a dog, you're half as likely to be obese as compared with not owning a dog, because a dog is one of these perfect nudges.
Yeah, yeah.
The dog needs to get walked every single day. So guess who else gets to be walked every
right,
day?
Right. Grow your own garden. That's a big one.
Easy nudge, especially this time of year.
Yeah.
You got to do something in there every day.
I liked this, too. You said grow plants inside your home.
Once again, you got to get up and water them every few days and tend them. And there's some research that suggests that certain types of plants actually filter out contaminants in the air. And the purity of our environment, air quality-wise, is also a determinant of life expectancy.
What do you mean optimize your furniture? That's another one.
Well, this was an interesting observation. So in Okinawa, you see these 80, 90-year-old women who have no couches or chairs in their house. They're getting up and down 30 or 40 times a day off a tatami mat. And that's like doing 30 or 40 squats over time.
Yeah.
So they have much better lower body strength and balance. And lo and behold, the number of hip fractures they have is about a quarter of what we see in America. So, again, an environmental opportunity, I believe.
It sort of gets at a question that comes from Ben. He says, in America, as we get older, we're encouraged to take it easy, lay back, and enjoy life. He says, I'm only in my 30s, but it seems to me that the more you lay around as you get older, the less time you'll have to get older. How much do people in the blue zones move around? I guess you've already sort of gotten to that point. They move around a lot.
Yes, and it diminishes over time.
Sure.
I mean, when you think about how to set up your house, until you're about 70, you want it full of nudges that get you to move. And then after 70 or 80, you want to switch those nudges so you're less likely to have an accident, trip over something and hit your head or break a hip. Hips, if you break your hip in a year, there's a 25% chance you'll be dead at the end of the year. So he brings up a really good point. There is a shift with age.
I think one of my favorites is ikigai, have a purpose. That's an Okinawan term. Have a reason to get up. In Costa Rica, it's the plan de vida. It's have a purpose. That's a big one. Would you say something about that? That's my favorite, I think.
Sure. So you start out, and we observe this. In all blue zone, there's a strong sense of purpose. And doing my research, the former director of the National Institutes on Aging, Dr. Bob Butler, it turns out he had done a study on purpose. And he retrospectively following a group of people, older people for 10 years, found that those people could clearly articulate their sense of purpose were living about 8 years longer than those people who were rudderless. So then that provided kind of a academic underpinning to what we're seeing in Blue Zones with Ikigai, people don't wake up wondering what they're supposed to do. Mm-hmm. In Okinawa, by the way, the highest mortality after retirement were cops and professors. These are guys with a ton of status, and then all of a sudden the next day they retire and they have no status, and they die very quickly. And in Blue Zones, when I say Ikigai, Ikigai is kind of a combination of purpose and responsibility. It's not like, you know, they go self-actualize for the next 20 years. They're imbued with a sense that they're okay, they've lived their whole life, but they have this repository of wisdom that they're expected to give back to the younger generations, expected to share the accumulated experience and the accumulated ways to deal with the famines and the economic downturns and the resilience to help increase the survivability of the next population. So again, it's a virtuous circle that is underappreciated in this country when it comes to health interventions.
Let me ask you one more thing. About a minute left. How do you describe the personal effect that this has had on you? I mean, you've talked about these conversations that you've had with people embedding in their lives. How did it make you consider your own life differently, do you think?
You can't do this for a decade and not have it change you some. So I eat mostly plant-based. I bike to the studio today. I knock off. I don't work beyond 5 p.m. It's given me an excuse to be social. I reconnect with my friends. I do yoga. I used to do super long distance running. Now I do yoga because I'm a big believer in regular low intensity physical activity. And I was just at the Mayo Clinic getting a physical, and they said they looked at my blood work. They said they've never seen better blood work for a guy my age. So it's working for me as well.
Great. Congratulations, Zen Buettner. He is the author of a number of books, among them The Blue Zones Solution, Eating and Living Like the World's Healthiest People. Joined us today from a studio in Minneapolis. Dan, thanks very much.
I loved it. Thank you, Doug.
Radio West, a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.